since the 1960s, and then in earnest since the late 1970s, executive clemency, really of any stripe, has fallen out of fashion in the United States in a very dramatic way. Pardons and commutations, which once were quite commonplace in both the states and our federal criminal justice system, began to drop markedly in the early 1960s. Since about 1977, the drop has been precipitous. Today, either form of executive clemency is almost non-existent in the states and nearly negligible for federal convictions, too.
What does the decline of pardons, commutations, and parole say about the purpose and function of the criminal justice system in this country today? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How have attitudes about rehabilitation changed since the 1970s? How has the withering of the parole system affected state budgets? And what role does politics play in clemency and parole? Our guest, once again, is Dean Strang, Madison criminal defense attorney, an adjunct professor at UW Law School and Marquette University, and the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror, published by the UW Press in 2013.
And welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you very much.
This topic, executive clemency, what interests you about that?
Well, you know, of course, my day job is defending people in criminal cases, and pardons and commutations are the last option, if you will, at what you might call the back end of our criminal justice system. And lawyers, defense lawyers and prosecutors, judges for that matter, anyone who works in a court spends most of our time in what you might think of as the front end of the criminal justice system. The charging of a case, the defending of it before trial, possibly a trial, certainly a sentencing in better than 90% of criminal cases in this country. And then setting aside an appeal, perhaps, the lawyers really are done with the case. And it's the corrections folks who live with many people who travel through our criminal justice system for much longer than do the lawyers and judges at the front end. At the back end, which can be years depending on the length of the sentence or the probationary term, you have bringing up the rear, if you will, in a conceptual sense, governors, parole boards, pardon authorities when that's shared in a particular state between the governor and some other administrative authority. And, you know, I've just found that interesting because for most of my lifetime, executive clemency in the form of a pardon, a commutation, a reprieve really has played a nearly invisible and certainly almost insignificant role in our criminal justice system. It wasn't always so.
Well, the biggest one, if this isn't skipping too far ahead, the biggest pardon, of course, on a big national level was Gerald Ford pardoning Richard Nixon in 1974.
That's right. And I think to some degree, President Ford's pardon of his predecessor probably plays into the near disappearance of pardons.
Really?
I think historians widely believe and political scientists widely believe that the pardon of Nixon was part of the reason that Gerald Ford lost
his bid. Yeah, I think that's pretty clear.
In 1976, his bid for a full term. And indeed, I think the argument can be made that both governors around the country in the various state houses and presidents have become very wary of granting any form of clemency, at least if they've got further political ambitions still to play out.
Because they'll look soft on crime or because it looks as if they're overstepping the bounds of the judicial system?
Interesting question, and maybe to some extent a little bit of both. But I think if we're talking about the last four or five decades, probably the concern is greater, at least for those, as I say, who still have political ambitions left. The concern probably is greater about looking soft on crime. You can go back to 1966 when Ronald Reagan runs successfully to be governor of California and see probably the first campaign that largely rests, not entirely, but largely rests on a get tough on crime message. And then Richard Nixon picks up on that just 2 years later in his first and successful run for the White House in 1968.
Does that come out of, do you suppose, Vietnam War unrest and then the war on drugs? Is that where there's this sense that suddenly we have crime all around us and we have to clamp down on it?
I think Vietnam era unrest is part of it. The war on drugs I see as being a product of this get tough on crime mentality, not a cause of it.
Really?
Because the war on drugs really heats up in the 1980s. And that when Ronald Reagan ascends to the presidency, he picks up the theme again of a need to address crime more harshly and an effort to curtail the flow of illegal drugs becomes a centerpiece of that effort. But I do think Vietnam-era unrest and unrest associated with the civil rights era, to the extent that that's separable from the discontent during the Vietnam War, probably more than anything are the two factors that led to a widespread popular sense that order, societal order was crumbling, that there was a wave of crime. The Vietnam War and the civil rights era give us the first opportunity, if you will, in American life to see domestic cities on fire or police officers dressed in riot gear and confronting large groups of unruly people.
And interestingly, the administrators who were probably most prominent when it came to dealing with large-scale unrest were governors calling
yes.
in the militia.
Yes. Yes. I think that's absolutely right, or a National Guard response. But all of that, because of television, comes into the American living room for the first time in moving pictures in a way that's very different than a black and white photograph on the front page of a newspaper might have been a generation before the 1960s.
So a governor, in effect, has this image of getting tough on crime if he's in the media calling in the National Guard to restore order.
That's, I think, certainly part of it. And what happens is the notion of getting tough on crime becomes a pretty effective theme, campaign theme, a pretty effective way to move up to higher elected office. I think in very recent years, that's become a less trenchant theme, but nonetheless, still, no one wants to look soft on crime. No elected official, really.
Including judges.
including judges. But, you know, in the last 40 or 50 years, really no elected official wants to risk looking soft on crime.
This is a kind of basic question, but what are the rules as to who can issue a pardon and under what circumstances in terms of what a governor can do and what, you know, on the federal level can be done to issue a pardon?
Let's start with the states because, you know, most people who are convicted of a crime are convicted of a state law crime. And therefore, to the extent they're seeking clemency, it would be within the state system they're seeking it. The states vary a little bit. But most state constitutions vest the exclusive authority for granting a pardon, a commutation, or some form of clemency either in the governor or in the governor and some administrative board, a pardons board, a clemency board that the governor typically would appoint and at least loosely oversee. On the federal side, the United States Constitution vests the exclusive authority to grant clemency in the president.
And how common is it, if you look, you know, over the last decades, how common is it for a sentence at the state level or at the federal level to be commuted or?
Well, let's just use the 20th century as an example. In the early decades of the 20th century, pardons and commutations were very common. They really were very common. The data are somewhat hard to gather, but probably the easiest body of data to work with and to acquire concerns death penalty cases. And, you know, until about 1960, if you were sentenced to death and sent to death row in this country, you had somewhere between a 1 in 4 and a 1 in 6 chance of either having that sentence commuted to life or being pardoned outright. Really not bad odds. Now, in the 1990s, those odds in death penalty cases came to be more like you had a 1 in 170 chance of a pardon or an executive commutation. It's a little bit, it's not deceiving, but what one has to bear in mind, also a parallel trend, is that since the 1950s or 1960s, the courts have become more active, I think it's fair to say, in reviewing death sentences especially. Let me put it this way. Most death row inmates in this nation today and in the recent decades who get some relief from the death sentence, most of them are getting that relief from the judicial branch, not from the executive branch.
So in other words, some kind of like review of the case rather than an intervention.
An appeal, some kind of a post-conviction remedy, habeas corpus, either a state habeas remedy or a habeas corpus writ in federal court. Now, Congress has cut back on that, on the federal court's jurisdiction to overturn state sentences since the mid-90s. But nonetheless, in a broad sense, it's true that relief from a sentence, especially of death, has shifted from governor's mansions and the president really to the courts in more recent decades. And far fewer people are seeing any relief from death sentences and other long terms of imprisonment at all.
If it goes through the court system, I would venture to say that even if there is relief, it's going to take a lot longer than simply a fiat from the governor's mansion.
Yes, although I think it's also true that governors and presidents typically let the judicial process run its course. And that would have been true 100 years ago, as it has been true in more recent decades. Now, the judicial process may have run its course faster in many cases in 1913 than it does in 2013. But I think it's generally been true that presidents and governors have let the judicial process run its course. The exceptions have been the really high-profile defendant or potential defendant, Richard Nixon, Louis Libby, who got some relief, but maybe more notably Caspar Weinberger, the former Secretary of Defense, who was pardoned before he even was charged or convicted by President Bush. So there have always been some sort of high-profile outliers. But for the mine run of cases, usually the judicial process runs its course first.
And the concept is that this is for who is good, the good of the people, the good of the pardoned or commuted sentence holder?
Well, people who've looked at this in much greater depth than I have identified anywhere from two or three categories of reasons for pardons to nine, if we're talking about the late Professor Badao. But I think in general, we can think of pardons as being either some sort of an act of mercy or an act of recognition of rehabilitation, or designed to cure an obvious mistake of the judicial system
really, that's
gone unremedied.
But you think the Nixon case would fall into that? My vague recollection was that the idea was that we need to move on and that it would not be to the benefit of the country to have a big showcase trial of the president of the United States.
Well, and that, another category would be sort of other.
Which we hope doesn't other, come up too often.
Other would include really rare situational instances like pardon of ex-President Nixon, where at least I thought President Ford had a credible argument that the country just needs to move on. We need to close this chapter, put it behind us, and look forward. But also in this, you know, catch-all other category, if you're thinking of pardons or clemency that way, you would have to include people who just either seem to be well placed for whatever reason, friends of the governor or with friends in high places, friends of the president or with friends in high places, or themselves are public figures. I mean, I'll give you one example is Charlie Crist, when he was the soon-to-be outgoing governor of Florida several years ago, mm-hmm. posthumously pardoned Jim Morrison. The old rock singer.
from the Doors.
From the Doors. Why? Because Governor Crist had liked Jim Morrison's music. And
that's pretty strange.
Posthumously, he would pardon him for his indecent exposure conviction in Florida once upon a time. So there's those kind of things. There's the Caspar Weinberger example. President Clinton ran into really a hail of criticism near the end of his second term when he pardoned a number of people, and there were deep suspicions that he did this because of personal or political
cronyism,
that sort of thing. And I think that perception, which may have begun with the Nixon pardon, I think that perception of cronyism, which is a good word for it, is part of why pardons and commutations have come to be in relatively bad odor.
I think he used the date 1977 as one of the turning points, and that would be right after this, Nixon phenomenon.
Right. Professor?
You also mentioned the civil rights situation. Have there been times where a federal pardon rectified a state-level civil rights abuse or something where racism in a state was behind a sentence and then a federal situation took care of it?
There have been in rare instances, and I think unfortunately usually those pardons have been posthumous as well. I can't call to mind a name right at the moment, but I know that I've seen articles about governors pardoning mm-hmm. long ago convicted people where the suspicion was that racism deeply affected the proceedings. The one I have one of the cases that I have somewhere in the recesses of my mind included a number of black soldiers, and there may have been some officers among them, who were court-martialed. I can't tell you whether it was early World War II. Or
there were some, yes, from 1945. That's right.
Court-martialed for mutiny allegations or refusal to obey orders. And I know that a president in much more recent years granted an unconditional pardon to those men, most or all of whom I think were probably gone by then.
Because I was thinking the pros and cons of the pardon. The cons obviously would be the cronyism, when it's used or when it's sort of an idiosyncratic, I like this singer in this group. But I suppose the pros would be when you have the ability to intervene when there's been something that's been, unjust.
Right. Let's take another example. If memory serves me right, Fred Korematsu was pardoned. Who was he? Well, he was a young Japanese-American man who was interned, along with thousands of others, out on the West Coast during World War II under military order. And he was prosecuted for violating the curfew or internship order. That case went to the United States Supreme Court, where infamously the military's power to intern American citizens without suspicion of wrongdoing on American soil was upheld. And I think late in his life, Fred Korematsu was pardoned by, a president that was probably – that may have been in this century or certainly in the 1990s before – that injustice was corrected.
We're going to look further at this phenomenon of the dwindling of pardons and commutations and paroles. We'll look at a couple of notable cases, too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Dean Strang, and we're talking about the phenomenon of pardons, commutations, and paroles, all of them way down in this country, particularly in the last 35 or 40 years. We haven't touched on parole yet, though. Is it part of the same package, part of the same phenomenon?
Well, parole, generally speaking, would be an executive branch function and, you know, a termination of a sentence, releasing a prisoner at least before the maximum sentence imposed judicially. Parole is a little bit different than a pardon or a commutation or a reprieve in that parole, where it's authorized at all, is authorized by the legislature. It's not purely an executive act.
Really? I mean a routine parole where somebody has
The structure to grant a parole, the parole ability of a sentence is established legislatively, and governors also exercise almost always no personal individual control over a given parole. Rather, that's committed to an administrative body within the executive branch, but operating with express legislative authorization. Now, parole is down in this country because beginning in the early to mid-1980s, we really had a shift away from better than a century of what was called indeterminate sentencing toward a model of determinate sentencing. And what I mean by that is anywhere in America, if you were sentenced in 1950, let's say, to prison for a crime, the judge would impose a term of years, and that's the maximum amount of time you could have served.
Would it be like 10 to 20? Would it be that wide?
It might have been expressed as 10 to 20. It might have been expressed simply as, you know, 30 years or 5 years or 25 years or whatever. But some outside maximum period of time would have been imposed by a judge. And then within that outer limit, a parole authority in whatever state we might be considering or the Parole Board of the United States, the Parole Commission of the United States, would have been able to consider possible early release after some threshold minimum period of time had been served in prison. Now, some inmates weren't released early. Others were, but not as early as they might have been. But that's where the sense of indeterminate sentencing came. You know, you're sentenced to up to 25 years, but in fact you might serve less than that if you mind your P's and Q's in prison.
So at a certain point in this sentence, a minimum point, I assume, of time served, you're eligible for parole and you go before a parole board.
That was the old system.
Thumbs up or thumbs down.
Right. And then if the thumb was down, well, you would be given a period of time after which you could apply again, typically a year or sometimes 2 years. And that was the system across all of the states and, for that matter, the federal system in the United States. And then in the early 1980s, Congress especially begins to really question that model and begins to propel the country toward a determinate sentencing scheme, something that came to be called truth in sentencing.
Yeah, and that was quite the political catchphrase, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And that the impetus for that, I think, really at least begins in Congress. 1984, Congress passes a law that establishes for the federal courts with federal crimes a system of determinate sentencing. so that the parole commission will have no more role to play.
And is that because it was seen that people would be given a sentence and then it didn't seem to mean anything because they were back out on the streets much sooner than any jury anticipated?
That was the political perception, and I think to some extent the popular perception, is that judges would impose these sentences that sounded like forever, and then somehow after 7 years the murderer mm-hmm. is back out on the street.
Well, like a life sentence, for example.
Life sentences also were parolable. As an historical matter in this country, a life sentence was parolable. Now, typically you had to serve some minimum amount of time. In Wisconsin, we still can impose a parolable life sentence when a judge doesn't tinker with parole eligibility on a life sentence in this state. You currently have to serve 13 years and 4 months before you're eligible for consideration for parole. Now, no one gets out on a life sentence in Wisconsin before about 20 years, and very few are lucky enough to be paroled that early. But you're eligible after a period of time. Today, with Truth in Sentencing, Wisconsin judges also can raise the parole eligibility date to any date the judge might choose, or can deny parole eligibility altogether, imposing what's called life without parole. So that trend begins with Congress. As I say, in 1984, in the United States sentencing guidelines and the system of determinate sentencing takes effect in the federal courts in November 1987.
And then how does that trickle down to the state level?
It trickles down to the state level because I think really for two reasons. One, in recent decades, often the states have tended to emulate federal moves on criminal justice issues and others. Two, in the event states weren't so inclined to emulate Congress, Congress gave the states some real incentives. By the mid-90s, Congress was tying corrections grants from the federal government to a requirement that states adopt new sentencing laws that would require inmates mandatorily to serve at least 85% of the sentence imposed.
And so that in turn comes from people in Congress who were elected on certain platforms or understandings.
Yes. And a related trend toward what I think you can call in some ways legislative sentencing, which is to say a related trend toward the enactment of minimum mandatory sentences established by a legislature runs in parallel with this trend toward determinate sentencing. So Congress begins to say, for example, for certain drug crimes, that if you're convicted of selling more than 500 grams of powdered cocaine, you must be sentenced to at least 5 years in prison, and it can go up from there, sort of tying the hands of judges so that they can't impose what legislators began to view as weak-kneed sentences.
Well, and would you say that some of the change goes along with a changed attitude towards whether rehabilitation is possible within the prison system?
Yes, absolutely. I personally think that all of these trends, the virtual disappearance of executive clemency, the migration away from parole in sentencing, minimum mandatory sentences, I think all of them are a piece of a loss of faith in rehabilitation, at least rehabilitation through correctional systems, and maybe in redemptibility of people more broadly.
Why would that change, do you think?
Well, I think to some extent recidivism rates are easy for politicians and then the public to focus on, the perception that prisons have become a revolving door.
Were the rates higher, recidivism rates?
Recidivism rates are, you know, are trends that have varied state to state. They go up, they go down. I'm not a scholar in that area, especially, but it's perception, I think, as much as anything, that people are getting out of prison and then committing new offenses and heading right back into the system. That's caused really politicians to rethink what the role of the prison is.
But they didn't rethink the nature of parole and how that might somehow be modified to reduce recidivism?
Well, at least the trend in the 1980s and 1990s was away from parole. And the federal system and many of the states kept a small safety valve, if you will, of granting a minimal amount of credit for good behavior by inmates. But other states, Wisconsin among them, retained not even that, not even a reduction for good behavior. Rather, Wisconsin adopted a bad behavior system so that if you misbehaved while in prison, time would be added on to the judicially imposed sentence rather than subtracted from it. Now, the pendulum swings. In 2005, the United States Supreme Court invalidated the United States sentencing guideline scheme to the extent that it was mandatory, to the extent that it bound judges to impose formulaic sentences calculated on a grid. The United States sentencing guidelines remain, but they are now advisory. We haven't seen parole be reinstated federally, but we have seen federal sentences begin to come down in average length. You're also beginning to see that in many states. Why? Because as we've gone to longer sentences and eliminated parole, corrections budgets in the states have mushroomed. They have expanded dramatically.
You have a remarkable comparison for Wisconsin in that regard, that the amount of money spent on corrections is more than what the entire state university system gets?
Those lines crossed over in 2011. Since 2011, Wisconsin now has been spending more on its corrections, its Department of Corrections, than it does on all of the publicly funded state universities combined in the state. And that's not unique to Wisconsin. Many states are seeing the same trend, more on corrections than on higher education. And the growth in corrections budgets really has come to be seen as unsustainable in many states. So they're retrenching.
I think I've seen a statistic, too, that indicates particularly for African-American and Latino men that there are more in prison than in college, and that some of these sentencing changes, the lack of parole and other things, are hitting particularly hard in those populations.
Because, yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. And, you know, nationally, the numbers are something now like 1 in 4 men under a certain age of all races either being in jail, in prison, or under some form of corrections supervision, probation, parole, some sort of community supervision. Just staggering numbers. Our rate of imprisonment in this country is the highest in the developed industrial nations.
Can you say something about the Willie Horton ad that ran during the Dukakis campaign against him, and how various political campaigns have sometimes played on or preyed on the public perception of crime?
Well, let's back up a little bit. As I mentioned, Professor Badao and others have noted this strange, sharp fall off in pardons and commutations beginning about in 1977, 75, 76, 77, somewhere. The numbers really seem to fall off the table and have continued that precipitous decline. So why is that? That's certainly before the Willie Horton ad in the 1988 presidential race. But I think one of the reasons, I'm speculating here, but this is an interesting historical puzzle. But in 1976, you have Jimmy Carter elected president. He breaks a long drought, I think, of six presidents back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a long drought in which no governor or former governor had been elected president between FDR and Carter. And when with Carter being elected, he's also very different than the other presidents we've had who were themselves former governors, Roosevelt being the most recent before Carter. Carter is not born into wealth as FDR was and into a privileged family. Carter didn't have a distant cousin who had been a president of the United States before him, as Franklin Roosevelt did in Theodore Roosevelt. Carter is not from the most populous state in the country, as Roosevelt was. New York was by far the largest, by about 30%, the largest state population in 1932 when Roosevelt was elected. Carter's a relative outsider, and he's from Georgia, a relative outsider state. And I think
campaigns as an outsider, too.
Absolutely, he does. And my suspicion is that what happens is that around the country, governors and people who wanted, who aspired to be governors, took note of this and said, you know, maybe becoming governor of a state is not a terminal office anymore. Maybe it's a stepping stone to to a higher office yet. And indeed, since President Carter, three of the five presidents we've had since then have been former governors.
So I suppose they'd have to watch what they do in terms of how they decide on cases because it can
come
back to haunt them.
And that's where I think it comes back to executive clemency, because if you've made it to the pinnacle, so to speak, in the state system, and you're now the governor, but you have a higher ambition yet to run for president, you want to be very careful about exercising mercy and either wiping clean criminal convictions or releasing people from death row to a life sentence or releasing people serving terms of imprisonment from prison altogether.
So what did Dukakis, who had been governor of Massachusetts, do vis-a-vis Willie Horton that made him such a political liability?
Well, the irony for poor Michael Dukakis is he didn't do anything as to Willie Horton. Horton was a Massachusetts inmate who received an administrative furlough, may have been just for a weekend or for a matter of days. He was furloughed from prison for some reason and committed a crime while he was out on furlough. Now, again, Governor Dukakis had nothing to do with that.
Just it was the state system that handled
it. The State Department of Corrections that furloughed Mr. Horton briefly and to tragic effect. But in the 1988 presidential race, the first President Bush, or his campaign, was able to use that episode to very good effect against Michael Dukakis, who was a governor of a state aspiring to the presidency.
We're going to look at two famous Wisconsin cases when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Dean Strang, the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. Today we're talking about vanishing executive clemency and the way that pardons and parole have not been used as much as they used to be. You work as a criminal defense lawyer here in Wisconsin. Can you comment on a couple of cases that you've been involved with where the issue of parole has come up?
Sure. I guess two come to mind. The first one was a homicide case in Marathon County. The county seat is Wausau. A number of years back, I was actually a lawyer, not yet 30 at the point that this case was tried, and I assisted my older partner and mentor, a wonderful lawyer named Steve Glynn, in defending that case. Our client had been a sophomore in college. She was the rival of another young woman her age for the affections of a handsome a local dairy farmer. Our client confronts the other young woman. They get into an argument, and in the end, our client manually strangled the other young woman with that young woman's belt. She goes to trial on a charge of first-degree intentional homicide in the very early days of Wisconsin's shift to a system in which a life sentence, which we've had since the beginning of statehood for first-degree murder, could be converted into a life without parole sentence by the judge at the time of sentencing if the judge thought it appropriate to deny even the possibility of parole. And this client was convicted of first-degree intentional homicide. The judge had the option, as I say, because the law had just changed, the judge had the option of denying her the opportunity ever to be considered for parole if he chose, or extending the number of years she would have to serve before consideration for parole. That judge chose to do neither. He left in place the statutory scheme of ordinary parole eligibility. But that client now remains in prison, a model prisoner, almost 23 years after sentence was imposed. She has spent more time in prison than she spent on earth out of prison.
And applying for parole at regular intervals?
Yes, and moving down to minimum security, where she's been for the last 3 years, and getting support from the people at the prison to which she's assigned and from the parole board for moving her into community custody, where she'd have a chance to work outside the walls and prove herself in the community for a period of time before an actual parole. And I think really for political reasons, she's become stalled at exactly that place.
Was it true that just one person in that whole collection of people, including the parole board, can sideline an appeal?
It's not an appeal, but can sideline a parole.
The application, I mean.
It is. It is true that as few as one administrator in the Department of Corrections can do that, or one or two or three parole commissioners. Now, here the parole board hasn't been the problem, but she's stalled with a parole almost within eyesight for her, has done everything she possibly could to prove herself rehabilitated. The Department of Corrections itself describes her conduct as excellent in writing. The people at the prison, as I say, and the parole authorities have recommended that she get community custody, and it just has not happened.
Does the victim's family play a role when parole is being considered?
They can be heard, and they certainly should be heard, actually. And I don't know what the victim's family has done in this particular case. They are still in Wisconsin. They suffered a horrible loss, obviously. I don't know what role they've played, and I think victims' families rightly should be heard as one of a number of voices and considerations in the parole process. But there is inevitably, I think, a political quality to this, not in a partisan sense, but just in a sense of how high profile is the case, what's the public reaction likely to be if we parole you, and will elected office holders look bad if that happens? This particular client, whose case was a fairly high profile case, gosh, indeed, a made-for-TV movie was modeled on it. She has seen people convicted of the same crime, first-degree intentional homicide, but with much lower-profile cases, come in after her and leave on parole before her.
So the system can have some definite inequities even after incarceration. I mean, having nothing to do with the actual conditions in the prison, but just in the review process of these applications for parole.
Well, and parole decisions invariably are discretionary. And, sometimes discretion works for you in a subjective way, and sometimes it works against you in a subjective way.
That seems to be the key word there, subjective. It can be a subjective process.
The other case I have in mind is a much more recent and very notorious case. Stephen Avery is the name of the defendant. Jerry Buting and I represented Stephen in his first-degree intentional homicide case tried in 2007. Avery was famous in the state because he served 18 years on a really violent, brutal rape that he did not commit. And the DNA later both cleared him of responsibility for committing and identified the actual perpetrator.
I have to say, I heard Stephen Avery when he spoke in just a few weeks before the murder that he would then commit. He was brought out as a sort of poster child of the Wisconsin Innocence Project to show their excellent work in getting people released who were unfairly convicted of a crime. But it was so horrible then, just a few weeks later, to have him back in the news. You know, he had been right up in front of a whole class of mine speaking, to have him then in the news again, having committed a murder. I'm thinking that the effect on the Innocence Project must have been rather devastating at first.
Well, I think I can't speak for them, but I think emotionally it was crushing for a lot of people to see Stephen exonerated in 2003, finally released, starting to get his life back on track, and then in 2005 to be arrested and charged with murdering this 25-year-old photographer who was last seen at the Avery auto salvage yard.
With some pretty, as you say, lurid testimony from his nephew as a witness.
The nephew never testified, and that's a common mistake that people understandably make.
Did this get into the record at all then? Where did
it got into the public record immediately because the 17-year-old nephew gave a very questionable confession some months after Mr. Avery was charged. And the prosecutor at the time held a full-blown press conference with the cameras running and the tape recorders running and the microphones in bank in front of him, and gave the lurid details of this young man's statements to law enforcement. And although none of that came in Stephen Avery's trial, none of it was part of the evidence at trial. The nephew never testified at Stephen Avery's trial. I don't think he even testified at his own trial later.
But
that imagery of that press conference by the prosecutor got seated in the public mind.
And would almost inevitably then affect the judgment of anyone involved in a possible parole for Avery down the line. I mean, in other words, the people who make those decisions are not shielded the way a jury is supposed to be.
Well, and as things stand, no one will ever consider a parole for Stephen Avery. The first case about which I spoke was, you know, that trial was in June of 1990. The Avery verdict came in the middle of March 2007. And in the intervening 17 years, judges in the state had become much more comfortable increasing parole eligibility dates or denying eligibility for parole altogether. And the judge in Mr. Avery's case imposed a sentence of life without parole. So barring some judicial relief at some point, which has been denied so far, Stephen Avery lost his appeal. But barring some sort of extraordinary judicial relief or a change in our laws, he will never be eligible to be considered, even considered.
And what about the years that he served unfairly then? That's just sort of nothing happens because of that.
No credit for time served on a different rap?
Nope. You don't get those years back. He had sued Manitowoc County for the time, for the 18 years spent as an innocent person in prison. That lawsuit was coming to a head when this young woman disappeared. And after Avery was charged with Teresa Hallback's murder, his lawsuit wasn't worth much anymore. He settled it on really nominal terms at that point. And he's right now, as things stand, he will die in prison without any parole authority ever having the opportunity even to consider him for release.
Well, there is another phenomenon that we see that would, I suppose, cloud the case even if he were to be eligible for parole or any other inmate in the same situation, and that is sometimes a person proven innocent of one charge and released is not necessarily a nice guy just because he didn't commit that particular crime.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. No question about it. And many people, not just in Wisconsin but elsewhere, who've been exonerated have been people with one or more or several prior criminal convictions before the crime that led to their wrongful conviction.
And sometimes subsequent ones after release.
That's been much rarer, actually. Very few of the exonerees nationwide have gone back to prison or back into the criminal justice system. Stephen Avery is a really unfortunate exception in that regard. But many of these people become suspects, easy suspects,
yes,
in crimes that we later learn they did not commit precisely because of their prior lives, their prior records. They're, you know, they are not implausible people to suspect.
So do you have final thoughts on executive clemency and whether we need more of it
or
whether the system
go?
Is the right way now?
Well, I have opinions on that, and it, you know, my own opinions rest in my view that we need to work toward administering criminal justice with a great deal more humility than we currently do. Not cowardice, not unwillingness to do our jobs, but just humility about the possibility of our own failings and shortcomings. And I think some availability of you know, a fairly strong availability of mercy or recognition of exceptional rehabilitation in prison both would serve us well societally and fit, I think, with an attitude of greater humility about the fallibility of our system of justice.
Our guest has been Dean Strang. Thanks for joining us and having a look at this phenomenon of pardons and commutations and paroles and the way the whole thing has changed in the last 40 years or so.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for our next hour of University of the Year.